It's important to know that the Hebrew word that is translated as widow is translated to mean one who is without a voice. So a widow is one who is without a voice. And so here we have this story that Jeanette just read for us of a widow, one who is without a voice, who is demanding justice. And she is coming before an unjust God, one that we are told an unjust judge, one who we are told does not even fear God. And she comes before this judge again and again and again. And if you live in a broken world where power is in the hands of a few, which is indeed the world in which she lived in, power was in the hands of men, and of a few men was great power concentrated, where some voices carry all weight, and where the voices of some are utterly dismissed time and time again, it is only concerted persistence time and time and time again that gives you a chance, no guarantee, but a chance to at least be heard. So even this one who is a widow, unable to speak, going up against one who is utterly disinclined to hear her anyway, even this one, we are told, is finally heard. Her cry for justice is heard. And as I read that story and hear that story, I wonder if we are in a moment in time right now when those who have been unable to speak for generation after generation, those whom the world has refused to hear, who are calling for a more just world, a change from the way things have always been, are in fact beginning to be heard. Are we in a moment like that, that is unlike any other moment that we've had or that many of us have grown up? And now those of us that were on the Pride Parade yesterday, you might well have experienced that you were in just such a moment. To imagine that the only people that were in opposition to the Pride Parade were four people making fools of themselves on the side of the road, and everyone else, the thousands of people that were there, were celebrating the open and welcoming community and society that we long and yearn to create. Those are voices that once were not heard that are now being heard. One is talking about the same thing when you listen to the voices of young people like Greta Thunberg, the folks from Parkland Memorial High School, those young people that are voices that have not been heard, but are all of a sudden we are paying attention to. We are in a time where voices are being heard, but those are not the voices that I really want to think about today. I want to think about some that we may not even be aware of, and yet it is within the world conversation that we are a part of. And I want to begin by thinking about the work that a journalist by the name of Johan Hari did. You can go to TED Talks, YouTube, and look up Johan Hari, Johan spelled with two N's, H-A-R-I, and listen to his 20-minute talk. It's fascinating because what he's talking about is he has noticed that in this world, he is noticing that there has been a marked increase of those that are suffering from depression and anxiety, particularly in the Western world. And he was trying to figure out, as one who himself for much of his life has dealt with depression and anxiety, what's going on? Why is this happening? And what he did was he embarked on a worldwide journey, put 40,000 miles on his frequent flyer card, flew all around the world, met with therapists all around the world, met with communities that are dealing with anxiety and depression, dealing with folks that are coming from a very dominant world perspective and those that have voices that are hardly being heard. And he began to put together a picture. And the picture that he began to put together was one in which we are living in a world where more and more people are disconnected from the earth, from God's creation. And more are not only people disconnected from the creation, they are disconnected from one another. They don't have communities. They don't have their own tribe. They don't have their village that they were a part of. And so they are living more and more isolated. And even more importantly, people are growing up in a world in which the values of seem to be that you can solve your problems through having more things. The more things you have, the wealthier you are, the better off you should be. And so the pursuit to get out of anxiety and depression for many people is a pursuit, like the rest of the world, to just get more stuff, to focus on oneself, to focus on style and stuff. And what he is noticing, and what he began to notice, is those very values that focus on that are dealing with style and stuff, are what he calls the junk food variety of values. And we know that if we were to go and leave church today and spend the next month on a diet solely of junk food, we know that it would not be good for our health. And what John Hari began to discover is that if our value system is one that really values primarily material goods, getting ahead in society, if those are the things that we are getting, it is the junk food of values, and it's not good for our social, our soul's health. And what he began to posit is this theory, is that the people who are suffering from depression and anxiety, the issue is not with them. That depression and anxiety is a soul crying out for a world and a system of values that is out of balance and out of whack. And that what we really need to be paying attention to is not saying you folks are dealing with depression and anxiety need to fix yourselves. Instead, the reality is we have a society, a set of values that is out of whack, that is disconnected, and it's there where the healing needs to begin. The balance needs to be recreated. Now, what he was focusing on was depression and anxiety. And the truth of the matter is, though, is I am completely convinced that depression and anxiety may well be the individual's response to a system that is out of whack, but we are actually all living in a social understanding and coming to grips with a system that is out of whack and out of balance. And we see it in many different ways. We see it in the fact that there is this unbelievable disproportionate distribution of wealth in our world. Did a little bit of research and a little bit of math this week, and I discovered that if we were to take all the money that the Walmart family, five or six people, or the Walton family, all the money that the Walton family makes in a year, and the Walton family, listen to this carefully, makes $4 million an hour off of Walmart, and if we were to distribute all of their money, let them have all the money they had already, and just earn nothing more, just take everything that they've earned, the bazillion dollars they're going to earn going forward, and redistribute that wealth to the folks that work there, every single employee would be above the federal minimum wage that is being proposed, and folks are of $15 an hour, and people are saying it's an impossibility. And in fact, if you concentrated it on the lower part of their 2.1 million people who work for Walmart, every one of them would now be a stable middle-class family. If you just took that egregious amount of wealth that half a dozen people are earning. Or let's take Jeff Bezos, the head of Amazon, who makes a whopping $4.75 million an hour. $4.75 million an hour, and you take that and you distribute all of that earnings to the 566,000 people, 566,000 people that work for a company that began selling books online, and you distribute that, and every single person would get a $16,000 a year raise. $16,000 a year for this man who's earning $4.75 million an hour. Or Mark Zuckerberg, who doesn't even compare to Jeff Bezos. He only makes $1.7 million an hour. But he only has 35,000 employees. If you took all of his money and redistributed, all the folks who work for Facebook would get a $100,000 raise per year. And those industries, Walmart, Facebook, Amazon, represent the very industries that Johann Hari is looking at as where the values, the junk values of a society are based on, in which it is all about stuff. Stuff and style. So I would say we have a community, if we have such disproportionate amount of wealth, we have a community that is beginning to understand that it's out of whack. And then go a little bit farther, and you look at the communities and cultures that are worldwide under siege, where there's implicit bias and privilege that is infecting so many communities, where our border policies, our immigrant policies, our urban, our rural policies are seriously impacting the lives of people. And then you look at a planet that is utterly in crisis, and you begin to see that we have a system that is out of whack and out of balance and is beginning to unravel. It's as if we've been living a system that, as long as there was an unlimited amount of natural resources, an unlimited amount of free labor, read slavery or indentured servitude, an atmosphere, oceans, rivers, and streams that could absorb the toxicity that we wish to throw into it, and enough firepower to keep all dissenters quiet. In short, if we had a system that is somewhat like this widow was experiencing there with this unjust judge, a system in which there is a lack of justice, in which power is concentrated in a very few people, and in which I would argue we are not showing respect at all like that judge for God, at least not God that I know, a God of unconditional love, a God of peace that passes all understanding. If that system, which functioned just fine for a few, is coming unraveled, it's becoming unraveled for everyone. And what I wonder, is it possible that right now in this moment, as that system unravels, falls out of balance, falls out of whack, that there are voices like the widow in this story, not only speaking, but quite possibly beginning to be heard once again. So let me share a little bit about those voices. There is a mountain where people have for many years been gathering in protest for the actions that are being taken on that mountain. And every day, for the last number of years, people have gathered on that mountain for prayer, to sing songs, some traditional cultural songs, some contemporary, to engage in traditional dance, to conduct ceremonies intended to honor, to unite, and to also proclaim defiance against what is going on that mountain, to provide hospitality to any who would come their way, sharing meals, places to rest, to sometimes sit in silence, to be there to support those who are willing to allow themselves to be arrested so as to protect that mountain, and to support those who are prepared to follow the same. This is persistence embodied, like the woman up against the judge. And if that sounds like Mauna Kea, it may well indeed sound like Mauna Kea, but I'm not talking about Mauna Kea. I'm talking about Burnaby Mountain, just to the east of Vancouver, British Columbia, where the indigenous Salish people and their supporters have been gathered for years, struggling against the TMP. I'm not making this up. It's not TMT, it's the TMP, the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which is a pipeline that they are trying to build from Alberta through British Columbia to transport bitumen that is coming from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada. Tar sands is the most pernicious way of extracting oil that we have discovered in our world, in which three times the amount of energy is necessary to crush this sand, to squeeze out the little bit of oil that is within it, and then a toxic amount of water has to be poured onto it, creating 30 square mile toxic ponds that, if they were to break, would destroy the lives of thousands of people down below, in order to transport that across lands that are the traditional lands of the Salish people, that were never ceded, that were never given, that were never bought, were just taken. And for years, the Salish people have been there at Burnaby Mountain, holding vigil, calling people to think about what is going on. Now, doesn't have to be Mauna Kea. Doesn't have to be Burnaby Mountain. It could be Standing Rock, North Dakota, that many of us were so aware of just a few years ago, where the water protectors of Standing Rock, North Dakota, resisted the North Dakota Access Pipeline going across the land that had been never given, never ceded, had just been taken. It could be, as Chuck has helped us to understand, the Gwich'in people in northwest Yukon, correct, Chuck? In northwest Yukon, who were standing to try and protect those Arctic lands where the caribou range in order to be able to stop the pipelines they want to be building there. It could be the traditional people of Labrador resisting the impositions of yet another hydro dam that, when built, will flood, will require the flooding of their traditional homelands. It could be the Kayapo people and other tribes in the Amazon who are trying to stem the destruction of the rainforest there, or the Maasai in Africa trying to hold on to traditional grazing lands, or the Maori standing firm against the destruction of the kin, the mountains, the streams, the rivers, the reefs, the shorelines. These indigenous voices of persistence are voices for justice, just like that widow. And these are voices being raised worldwide. And what they have in common is not that they are voices of protest or protection. What they have in common is that they are calling the world to a different way of being. They are recognizing that the system that we live in is out of whack and out of balance, and saying we need to return to the ways that they once knew. The water protectors of the Enbridge that are fighting against the Enbridge pipeline in the Great Lake region, saying they are striving to return to a time in which we knew how to live in balance and harmony with the land, where we could take that which was on our land and build our homes there. We could grow our own food. We could be subsistent on that which was here and live in balance and harmony and enjoy a high quality of life. As John Waterhouse, Indigenous Peoples Scholar at Oregon Health and Science University, says, as a global community, we have lost our way. We have forgotten what it means to have a relationship with the land. The future of our planet lies in indigenous ways of living on the earth. We have an indebtedness, we who are not indigenous. We have an indebtedness owed to the indigenous populations of the world, who represent now only 5% of the world's population. Imagine what that statistic means of the genocide that has happened, so that there is only 5% of the world's population is now indigenous people, but they manage or hold land tenure on 25% of the Earth's land mass and are responsible for 80% of its biodiversity. And in so many ways, hold the key in their understandings of how we need to live once again. The very qualities that journalist Johan Hari identifies as that which those with anxiety and depression are reacting to and longing for: a connectivity to the land, a connectivity to community, a value system that is based not on self-focused stuff and style, but is based on balance, harmony, substance, and soul, are the very qualities that these persistent voices for justice, a different way of being, are now being heard worldwide. The quote that you have on the top of your bulletin from David Orr, the full quote reads, "The plain fact is that the planet does not need more successful people, but it does desperately need more peacemakers, healers, restorers, storytellers, and lovers of every kind. It needs people who live well in their places. It needs people who live well in their places. It needs people of moral courage willing to join the fight to make the world habitable and humane." And these qualities, he says, have little to do with success as we have thus far defined it in our world. So when we hear the good news, When we hear the good news, if you are paying attention, that the eelgrass and the salmon are making a comeback due to the efforts of the Samish nations in the area that we now know as Puget Sound, we ought to be asking the Samish people, in what ways can the balance with creation that you all live and demonstrate become a part of our own lives? When we hear that our Maori neighbors have won a 140-year-old battle, the widow was persistent day in and day out, a 140-year-old battle to finally be able to recognize a river as a person and therefore to have the rights for its care, we ought to be asking, who then is our neighbor, not of the human variety in our community, awaiting our care? When we hear of the return to flourishing that has come to Yellowstone Park due to the reintroduction of the wolf into the park, we ought to be asking ourselves, whose lives can we assist in order that they are able to once again be part of a community so that not only will they flourish, but so too will our community flourish? And when we read that after years of neglect and abuse in Yosemite National Park, neglect and abuse that threatened the very lives of the 3,000-year-old giant sequoias of Mariposa Grove that were themselves suffocating because of the concrete and the asphalt and the trampling that we had allowed for generation after generation. And we read that instead the people of Yosemite National Park, guided by indigenous wisdom and guided by wisdom of so many others, came upon a plan in which they have totally changed the way that one will visit Mariposa Grove. All the pavement in the groves has now been torn up. The roads leading and out have been realigned, and the only way that you can come into the grove now is on footpaths. And all the paths have been taken away from the roots. The water that they desperately need has been allowed to come back to them. And importantly, no longer will they treat the grove as a place of recreation and entertainment, but it is now considered to be a place of reverence and restoration, inviting folks willing to be seekers who could hold the quiet with the sequoias. When we hear a story like that, should we not be asking the same questions? How do we hold the quiet that once was? How do we reconnect with God's creation? How do we reconnect with each other? How do we once again value soul and balance and harmony instead of self, style, and stuff? Jesus simply asks at the end, when I return, will I find any faithful people? He doesn't ask, will I find pious people? It's not about piety, although we have always defined faithfulness oftentimes by piety, how our prayer life is. Are we, as Barbara Brown Taylor says, like brushing our teeth, praying in the morning and praying in the evening? He asks, will I find faithful ones, not the pious ones? And the scriptures, being faithful, is always about those who live lives seeking justice, those who live lives seeking the peace that passes all understanding, shalom. Those who live lives of unconditional love, lives of aloha. Will we hear the voices, the persistent voices that are all around us worldwide now in ways that they have not been heard before, calling to us to such a way of living, voices that have long been ignored, but voices finally being heard? Will we join those voices? Will we be, are we now, the faithful ones that Jesus seeks? Amen.